Captain Curtis, The Untold Story. Written and read by Darrell Sloan. Website at www.midnightpictures.co.uk. It is recommended that the listener has some familiarity with the BBC television series The Tripods, from which this original story is derived. Captain's Log, 23rd of July 2089, Rimney. My hand is shaking so much that I can barely form letters on the page. Earlier today, while the crew loaded up the Orion, I happened to glance at the line of vagrants on the pier, chained together like convicts. When I recognised the girl at the front of the queue, my heart almost stopped. She was Jennifer. I didn't pause to consider the impossibility of this. That she couldn't be Jennifer, because Jennifer should be a year older than I, and I was now 52. And she couldn't be Jennifer, because Jennifer was dead. Nevertheless, nothing could stop me running across the pier, grabbing the girl and rubbing the dirt from her cheeks. Even when I had cleaned her up, she still looked like Jennifer. I had to clasp her face in my hands and stare at every detail, comparing her to a distant memory I had striven to bury, until the illusion finally cracked. One of my crew, Nick, was looking at me with grave concern. "Everything all right, Captain?" "Get back to work," I ordered, and quickly returned to the Orion. I have rarely spoken of Jennifer since she died, and I haven't thought of her in many years. But today's experience has taught me that one can never fully escape the demons of his past. Although I am not an expressive man, I cannot help but wonder if there might be some measure of relief to be gained in telling my secret, even to a lifeless book which no one else will read. We shall see. The last memory I have of Jennifer is the sight of her rising up into the air, her golden hair shaved off, her white robe billowing in the wind, a metal claw wrapped around her body. Then she did something that made me think everything would work out all right. She smiled and blew me a kiss. Seconds later she was gone, swallowed by the tripod. I was almost 14 at the time, and next year it would be my turn. I was looking forward to my capping. What I was not looking forward to was the in-between year, because I knew that Jennifer would be different now. She was about to become a woman, and I was still a boy. I wondered what would change. She was a passionate, feisty girl, and that was part of what I loved about her. Would the cap change that? Would she become dull? I knew I wanted to marry her one day, but I couldn't help fearing whether I would fall out of love with her before then. The year ahead couldn't go fast enough for me, for I knew my capping would put an end to those anxieties. Half an hour later, the panel on the bottom of the tripod spiraled open, and I waited for Jennifer to descend. You will recall that I said the kiss was my last memory of her. I said that because the girl who came down from that tripod, at least to my mind, was not Jennifer. The gathering applauded as the tentacle deposited the girl on the platform. Musicians were poised with their instruments, ready to commence the celebration. But even before Jennifer's feet touched the ground, I could tell from her tortured expression that something was wrong. When the claw released her, two ushers took her hands. Immediately she pulled free of their grip and started screaming, clutching her head in her hands. I knew what I was looking at. I had heard the stories. The girl whom I loved and hoped to marry had become a vagrant. Her broken mind would now condemn her to a life of wandering. She would never be my wife, and she would no longer even be capable of being my friend. In time, I learned to look back on the moment of her capping as the moment of her death. Everything that made Jennifer wonderful, everything that made her simply her, was gone. No one could drag me away from Jennifer's bedside while she struggled to overcome her fever. It was 5 days before she stabilized, Then she started exhibiting typical vagrant behaviour, the desire to wander. Some vagrants are afflicted more severely than others, from the mildly eccentric to the violently deranged. Jennifer fared quite badly. She would stir into space and make strange gestures with her hands. Occasionally she would lash out at those helping her. Worst of all, she had no memory whatsoever of her family and friends, including I. After two more days of rest, Jennifer was moved to the local vagrant house at the request of her parents. I hated them for that, and I despised them for being so calm about it all. How could a family continue to revere the tripods after a tragedy like this? I knew that the cap was responsible for their composure, and I suppose that was when I first began to hate the cap. The gulf between childhood and adulthood quickly became much more than I had ever perceived it to be. Adults spoke of great understanding that would be imparted by the cap, but I began to doubt. I hated them for their refusal to grieve over Jennifer's condition. I hated them for their refusal to blame the tripods. I hated them for their inability to feel how I felt. Inability. That was the right word. When I realized this, I began to understand what the cap was and what it was doing to people. It was turning them into puppets. It will not come as much of a surprise then to learn that when Jennifer left the village to commence her life of wandering, I went with her. It was senseless and it was futile, but what was there left for me at home? Nothing but the companionship of strangers and the anticipation of my own impending doom the following year. And so we wandered from place to place. I imagine there was a search, but my pursuers would have looked in the wrong kind of places, supposing that I had travelled through towns and taken board at inns. No one knew that I was posing as a vagrant, and as you know, vagrants are not tolerated amongst townsfolk. The disguise was perfected when I learned to make no attempt at personal cleanliness, thus blending in fully with my companion. I had discovered the art of unlimited travel, and although it was of little use to me, other than following Jennifer around, others have since used it for more practical purposes. Occasionally, Jennifer and I slept in a vagrant house, more often under the stars. I became skilled at thieving from farms, and that is how we lived. I took each day as it came, and I had no plans for how we would cope during the winter months. As it turned out, our journeying would come to an abrupt end long before winter, before even a month had passed. It's hard to convey in a few words how much of a toll those 26 days took on me. Hanging onto a relationship with Jennifer was like hanging onto a thread that had already snapped. She simply was not there. Not only was I heartbroken, I was invisible. Jennifer was locked inside her own fantasies, and she gave no indication that she knew I was with her, except for those few times when she assaulted me for no reason. Her final attack was so vicious that I feared for my life. She had me pinned to the ground, straddling my chest, with her hands around my neck. Her mouth spewed unpronounceable nonsense words in an angry roar. Panicking, I clawed at the ground. My fingers found purchase around a small rock. I smashed it against the side of her head. Jennifer's hands relaxed around my throat. Her body went limp, and she fell on top of me. The memory of embracing her rushed to the front of my mind. I wrapped my arms around her unconscious body and started to cry, wishing I could turn back time to when she had been whole. This was Jennifer's body, so warm and familiar, but now inhabited by a monster. A few minutes later, I rolled Jennifer over onto her back. I saw the cap glinting beneath her short new hair. I had struck her hard, but there was no blood. I took her wrist and felt her pulse thumping healthily under the skin. She was going to be all right. But of course, she was never going to be all right. The tripod had seen to that. I'm not sure of the exact moment that I decided to do the unthinkable. The decision came in stages. First, I used my knife to trim the hair away from around the cap. Then I tried to scratch the metal with the blade. After that, I tried to work the blade under one of the corners. Now there was a trickle of blood. What if she died? I thought. Perhaps that was a mercy. Wasn't it worth a try for a chance of making her whole again? I dug deeper with the blade. With a snap, one of the corners popped free of Jennifer's skull. I saw that it wouldn't just be a matter of the corners, though. The mesh of the cap was embedded in her skull all across its surface. And so I continued working. After 30 minutes, I had managed to disconnect around 2/3 of the metal contacts. Blood was trickling through Jennifer's hair and forming a sticky pool on the grass beneath her head. What happened next has haunted my dreams ever since. Jennifer opened her eyes wide and began screeching. I crawled away and covered my ears. I could do nothing but sit there and watch her body buck and writhe as if trampled underfoot by 100 horses. Foam spewed from her mouth. When she finally became still, I lifted her wrist a second time, expecting nothing, and finding just that. Before I buried her, I finished what I had begun, carefully cutting away the cap, drawing as little blood as I could manage. At the time, I had no thought whatsoever of how practical a false cap could be. I just wanted to bury Jennifer as Jennifer, not as the demented creature I had followed for the past month. If this tale of woe had ended there, I honestly think I could have borne it. I could have quenched my feelings of guilt with the knowledge that I had freed her spirit. And in truth, that is what I did. But it is not guilt that I live with every day, it is regret. Regret caused by the events which transpired 3 days later. I will speak more of this tomorrow. Just now, I find that my strength is all but gone, and I need a drink. Captain's Log, 24th of July 2089, the English Channel. We took on 2 new crew members today before setting sail. Boys. Runaways as usual. I don't remember their names. The dark-haired one was quite outspoken. Expected to get free passage to France, then expected me to give them French money. When I dismissed him empty-handed, he gave me a look of righteous indignation that made me despise him. I tell myself that it's good to be hard on boys like these, as preparation for the difficult journey ahead. Those who make it to the end always have tales of peril to share. I do these boys no favours if I extend the hand of friendship today. But that's not the whole truth. I am hard on the boy because I envy him, because I can never go back and be someone like him. Innocent, naive, overconfident, filled with enthusiasm for the quest ahead. I can never have a story to tell filled with brave exploits and hope. So it pains me to see that look on the face of a boy. Unfortunately, in my line of work, I see it so often that I am truly sickened. So I do what I do to take that look away. And if I can't achieve it, you can be sure that look is gone before the boy has trekked 30 kilometers through France. I've often wondered if there is forgiveness for a man like me. A man who took the life of a vagrant girl in the hope that he could save it. I have to believe that there is. But forgiveness does nothing to expunge the regret. Regret caused by the discovery that had I waited only 3 more days before I took her life, the outcome might have been very different. After burying Jennifer, I continued wandering aimlessly because, well, there simply was nothing else to do. I couldn't return home because I would surely be capped. I had willingly condemned myself to the life of a ghost, travelling through a land full of people but existing outside their perception, the only sane vagrant in the world. After 3 days, I encountered something unusual. Whilst trekking through a dense wood, I suddenly stopped, confronted by the oddest tree. Wrapped around its trunk was an animal hide. I looked around to find a reason for this curiosity, and saw that this tree was one of many similarly endowed, forming a straight line through the woods. I sensed that I was standing on the edge of a boundary of some kind, and yet there appeared to be nothing of interest within but more trees. Having no destination in mind, it made no difference whether I traversed the boundary or traced it. I did the latter. It amazed me that the hide markers continued for what must have been 5 kilometres, and who knew how many more in the opposing direction. When they finally ceased, my curiosity made me walk around the last tree. As I suspected, the markers continued in another direction. The angle was more V-shaped than L-shaped, too sharp for a rectangular enclosure, a triangle perhaps. Had the area been marked with human skulls on poles, a common practice in France to denote an area populated by particularly unsafe vagrants, I would have been hesitant to cross, but there was nothing unsettling about animal hides. And so I ventured forth. Half an hour later, having passed by nothing but trees and more trees, I was starting to think that I would shortly encounter the hides at the far side of the triangle, when suddenly the trees gave way to a clearing of about 1 acre. There were 5 dwellings, each constructed crudely out of felled trees, in a fashion I had never seen. Smoke rose from a chimney. My stomach rumbled at the thought of cooked meat. As I watched from my hiding place behind a dense bush, I saw a man enter the clearing from the far side, carrying several large fish in a net. A woman came out of a house with a basket of clothes. Both were dressed in an odd mix of ragged attire and animal hides. I couldn't understand what I was seeing. Why would anyone dress this way, as if they had no contact with the world outside their village? Vagrants were the only kind who lived like that, and this little community had already revealed far more industry than any vagrant was capable of. Was it possible that this was a village of outcasts who had chosen not to accept the cap? I would have my answers sooner than anticipated, for a hairy, muscular arm wrapped itself around my neck and a huge body pinned me to the ground. I heard the words, "Harper, get over here, we've got a newcomer." When the man pulled me to my feet, I caught a glance at the mesh of shiny metal embedded in his skull, and any excitement I felt quickly turned to fear. The community consisted of 11 persons whose ages varied from 17 to 70. After tying me to a tree, they stood around me in a semicircle and pried me with questions. Harper, the man I had seen with the fish, seemed to be a leader of sorts. He was not impressed to discover I was uncapped, and even less impressed to find the false cap in my pocket.
"Who are you? Where do you come from? Were you sent by Tripods? Why do you carry this? Why did you come here?"
When I kept silent for longer than Harper was prepared to tolerate, he delivered a hard punch to my stomach. The blow took me by surprise, because the last thing I expected from a capped man was aggression.
"That's enough, Harper," a young woman in her late teenage years retorted. "That boy could spell doom for us all, Danielle," Harper said. "He's uncapped."
"Good! That means he can go outside the triangle. He can get things for us, things we need to survive."
"Harper's right," an old bearded man said. "What do you think will happen to us if we let the boy go? He'll find his way home. He'll receive his capping. Then the Tripods will know all about their little mistake."
"That's enough," Harper ordered. "You've said too much, you fool."
"Who are you people?" I asked. "What is this place?"
Harper punched me in the stomach again, then grabbed a handful of hair.
"You're the one who's going to do the talking, boy, so let's hear it."
After Jennifer, I didn't care whether I lived or died.
so I looked back at Harper with my eyes blazing and my mouth shut. He was getting ready for another punch when Danielle stepped between him and I. "Let him alone," she said. Harper hesitated, then withdrew his fist. "All right, have it your way," he conceded. "But nobody touches his ropes and nobody gives him food." "We're not murderers," Danielle said. "What happens to the boy is up to the boy," Harper said. When he walked away, the others followed, leaving me alone. At dusk, I heard footsteps approaching. I raised my weary head, fearing another beating from Harper. Instead, it was Danielle with a bowl of hot soup. She brought the spoon to my lips and I accepted gratefully. "What's your name?" she asked. "Anthony," I said. "Anthony Curtis. I've been trying to figure you folk out, but I can't."
"Keep your voice down. The others aren't far away,"
I spoke in hushed tones.
"Your cap, is it false, like the one I had? I'm not supposed to talk to you."
"At first I thought you were all like me, people who didn't want to be capped. I thought you were runaways who somehow found each other and built this place. But there's more to it than that, isn't there?"
"You don't want to be capped? Why?"
"Danielle, I'll make a deal with you. If you answer my questions, I'll answer yours."
"Harper says..."
"I'm not talking to Harper, but I will talk to you. Do you want to hear my story or not?"
"All right then.
Why can't you go outside this triangle?" Danielle pointed at her forehead.
"So your cap is real?"
"Of course." "That doesn't make any sense. I know you're not vagrants, but you don't act like ordinary capped people either. The cap is supposed to stop aggression, but Harper..."
"If Harper stepped outside the triangle, he could never treat you that way again."
"I don't understand. It's just a line of trees. What difference does it make whether you're inside or outside?"
"The truth is, none of us really knows what this place is. We all found it at different times, by accident whilst travelling, and we all chose to stay. Vogan, the old man with the beard, was a sailor. He has travelled further than any of us in his life, and he has a theory about what the triangle is."
"And what is that?"
"A mistake. An oversight. That's why Harper's so worried about letting you go. If you end up capped, the tripods may find out about their mistake and correct it. But you won't let yourself be capped, will you?"
"No, that's what I told you.
But I still don't understand." "I've said enough. Now it's your turn. Tell me why you won't be capped."
"Because I hate the tripods." I expected Danielle's face to fill up with outrage, but instead there was excitement and delight, a reaction that should have been impossible for a capped person.
"Go on," she urged.
So I told her the story of Jennifer's capping and of our flight. By the end, I was fighting back tears. Danielle took a knife out of her pocket and cut through the ropes which held me to the tree. I sank to my knees in exhaustion. "That's everything," I said, "right up until Harper grabbed me. So, are you going to tell me what this place is?" Danielle crouched beside me.
"Have you ever heard of the City of Gold?"
I shook my head.
"Vogan has seen it. At least, he's seen the outside of it. It's a city surrounded by a gold wall, taller than the tallest building. And if you stood on the highest hill nearby, you still couldn't see over the top of the wall, because the whole city is covered by a dome which glows green night and day. Nothing comes in or out except tripods."
"What's it for?" I asked.
"No one knows for sure. But Vogan has heard that it's not the only one of its kind. He says there are three. And they are far, far away from each other in distant lands."
Danielle took her knife and drew three marks in the dirt, each equidistant from the others, in the formation of a triangle. Maybe like this.
If the cities form a triangle, what has that got to do with here? Your triangle is only a few kilometers wide.
Have you ever thought about how a cap works? How we can be restrained from curiosity and violence? How the thoughts in our heads can become known to the tripods?
I shook my head.
It's the city, Danielle said. We think the city of gold makes it work.
She took her knife and drew a large circle in the dirt around one of her marks. What's that?
Think of the city as having a voice that goes out in all directions, a voice that only the cap can hear. The circle represents the furthest distance the voice can carry. We know it's limited, otherwise the tripods wouldn't need three cities, would they?
I pointed into the circle. So, all the people in these countries are under the tripod's control? Danielle nodded. She drew another circle, the same size, around the second mark. I noticed that she allowed the circles to overlap. Finally, she did the same to the third mark.
Look at the center, she said. What do you see?
Right in the center of the design, the three circles have been overlapped in such a way as to leave a tiny triangular shape which was left outside of all the circles.
That's us, Danielle said.
This is amazing, I exclaimed.
Now the behavior of the villagers made sense. They were industrious because they were free. Harper was aggressive because he was free. I had discovered what I had never dreamed possible, a community of free-thinking men and women, a place perhaps where I could belong.
Danielle's expression was inexplicably sorrowful.
What's wrong? I asked. She shook her head. I took her by the wrist. If there's more to tell, I want to hear it.
Look at me, she said. I'm only 17. Look at my clothes. I wasn't a traveling merchant when I came here. Don't you realize what I was?
A sense of horror crept over me. I couldn't bring myself to say the word.
I was a vagrant, Anthony, Danielle said. So were three of the others. The triangle doesn't just bring capped people to their senses. It works for vagrants too.
Jennifer, I whispered,
and all the energy drained from my limbs. In that moment, I learned the meaning of the word regret.
If only I had waited. 3 more days was all she needed, if only.
I made a new home for myself among the folk of the Triangle and quickly became one of their most useful members, in that I was the only one who could come and go freely beyond the boundaries. Wearing my false cap, I was able to trade with neighbouring towns, obtaining vital supplies that enabled our village to thrive rather than merely survive. But eventually, 2 years later, I decided to leave. Living in the Triangle was a constant reminder that Jennifer could have been saved, and I needed to somehow heal that wound. So I tried to do it by pulling myself away from every reminder of her, especially Danielle. She is the only person to whom I have ever told the truth. Her constant sympathetic gaze eventually grew unbearable. Nowadays, when I am asked how I obtained my false cap, I tell a story about how I murdered a black guard to get it. The truth is too painful, and my tall tale has the useful effect of making people keep their distance. In time, my travels took me to the coastal town of Kilkeel, and that's where I fell in love with the sea. A place with no towns or villages or people, nothing but blue. A place where a man could learn to forget everything. So I took a job scrubbing the deck of a trading ship called the Orion. In the fullness of time, I became her captain. Now my tale is told. I want neither sympathy nor understanding. Tomorrow I may come to my senses and burn these pages,
but tonight I will sit here with my whiskey and my tears and my memories. I dare to hope that tomorrow's morn may be a little brighter than today's and yesterday's. We shall see.